The Basics of Genetics, Lecture 12. Regulating the Genes and the Dramatic Consequences of Regulatory Mutations.
In this lecture, I want to introduce you to a fairly advanced topic in genetics, but extremely important, and one that I think I can explain in this format, especially since we can use the metaphor of the cookie factory that we've had so far in our understanding of dog coat color. So you have the foundation for really making some forays into understanding this branch of genetics. It's about gene regulation. It's how the genes are regulated. And we have not yet talked about this, but it's probably one of the most fundamental things about the genes that we can talk about for reasons that will soon become apparent. So let me take you back to the cookie factory briefly. Recall that we have blueprints, one for each machine. Maybe they're mutated, maybe they're not. Recall that the mutations that are possible are many. So we sometimes talk about a whole series of alleles with many different possibilities, giving us a wonderful range of phenotypes. Dog coat colors were a great example of that. But what we have not yet addressed is how the blueprints are read. Perhaps this works if we continue with the cookie factory metaphor. Let's say that there was an additional factor besides the possibility of the blueprint being mutated. There was a possibility of whoever it is taking the blueprint and just completely misreading it, misunderstanding it, putting things together in exactly the wrong way. How could this possibly happen, you're wondering? Well, because there's more to this than just simply having a gene or just simply having a blueprint. In fact, there's a metaphor that I like to use for what a gene is, a linguistic metaphor. A gene is a little command, a little imperative statement that says, make this. Make what? Make this machine. Make this insulin. Make this hemoglobin. It's nothing but a little command. Now, there may be a mutation in that command so that we make the wrong sort of hemoglobin, the wrong sort of insulin, the wrong sort of machine, but it's nothing but a little command that says, make this. What's missing are the nuances of the grammar, and I like to call this the grammar, of what you need to really make this the right way, to make it where it's truly needed and if it's truly needed. I like to use this particular analogy when I'm describing this. Think of the cells that are in my elbow or the cells that are in your elbow. Those cells have exactly the same genes, exactly the same set of chromosomes as the cells in your eye. So what's the difference? We have the exact same set of genes, yet my elbow looks very, very different from my eye. Thank goodness it does. My eye looks very different from my elbow. How am I managing this if I've got the same set of blueprints in both of these structures, both of these tissues? Well, it's certainly not anything about the genes. It's about how the genes are being used. What the additional information has to be is the additional grammar, and I sometimes put this in terms of conditional clauses. Make this if we are in the elbow. Do not make this if we already have one. That's how I will prevent myself from getting double or triple elbows. Make this until we have exactly one, but not two. Make this only in the embryonic form. Make this only in the adult. Make this only at puberty. So these are all the little additional grammatical nuances that we need in order to use those blueprints. So I call that my elbow eye example. And if you remember elbow eye, then you've got the essence of this. We have to have the additional information to use these blueprints wisely. Otherwise, what do we have? We have pretty dramatic mutations is what we have. In fact, here is what we have for the roots of birth defects. If we want to try to understand birth defects, if we want to understand why you can get really dramatic sudden mutations such that structures are misplaced, structures are in multiples where they should not be in multiples, structures are missing, it's probably not a gene that is at fault. It is rather the grammatical aspect of how that gene was being used that is at fault. We're really talking about a different level of mutation, a really dramatic level of mutation. Visualize a gene. We know that it's a sequence of DNA that can be transcribed. Remember, we had that functional definition. It starts with a start, which is an ATG, and it ends with one of the stops, and it gets transcribed, and it gets translated, and we have that little functional definition of a gene. Nothing but a little command statement that says, go ahead and make this protein. Well, there's DNA that is upstream of the gene and downstream of the gene. And typically, we use those phrases upstream and downstream. So sequences just to one side of the gene and sequences just to the other side of the gene, upstream and downstream. And it's in those sequences that the grammar seems to reside. It's in those sequences where this additional subtle, crucial information occurs. All of these if statements, if we are in the elbow, if we are in the eye, if we already don't have two eyes and we need additional eyes. The grammar is between the genes. And what I want to evoke right now, again, is the length of the DNA information that we're talking about in a human, so I can put this into perspective. Remember I said we have 1.8 meters of DNA for every single cell. Okay, 1.8 meters. Actually, I like to keep a string of about 1.8 meters long in my pocket in case the information needs to be provided on the spot. In case we're in an argument about how much DNA there is, I can actually pull the string right out of my pocket. So I often have a string of 1.8 meters in my pocket. You might want to do that as well. Now, we only have 25,000 genes. Those genes take up less than 10% of the genome, less than 10%. So what's the other 90% of the genome doing? I take my string, I pinch off 10%, and I go, look, what's the rest of it doing, the 90%? By the way, those genes are throughout the genome, so it's not that all the genes are packed at one end, but 10% of 1.8 meters, that's not much. Well, much of the rest of the genome is of unknown function, but the function that we're beginning to understand little by little, much of it is grammatical. Much of it is the information just upstream and just downstream from every single gene that says, here's what you need to do with this gene in this particular context. I like to use a grammatical metaphor for this. I like to use a linguistic metaphor for this. And I like to make comparisons between the way we understand natural languages. So if you don't mind, I'm going to actually switch into thinking about natural languages for a minute. Let me tell you some generalizations about them and see if this works for what you understand of natural languages, English being the example, of course, that I'll use. The grammar and vocabulary of natural languages tends to be modular. That is, I have the and is and to and for. But it depends on where I put those, and I'm free to put them anywhere I want. I can take them like little modular pieces and stick them accurately, I hope, into whatever sentences I want. So there's a lot of repeat use of these modular pieces. In fact, natural language is nothing but repeat uses of these little modular pieces. We don't have very much in a natural language that's a single-use piece. Well, it's the same way with these particular sequences that are giving us the grammar of the genome. There's a lot of modular use of the same little sequences. There's a great deal of redundancy in natural languages. That is, there's lots of ways to say the same thing. I could say, I see a fire. I see a fire in the corner. Fire. Do you see that fire there? I mean, there are many, many different ways of saying the same thing. I can leave out words and still be understood. Same with the grammar of the genome. The grammar seems to have enormous redundancies in it, such that it makes it especially challenging to study if you go in and say, well, what happens if I remove this particular sequence? Well, I have completely disrupted the way this gene is being used. Maybe yes, maybe no. Okay. Same with an English language sentence. There are some words that are more important than others. I can leave the out of a sentence and still be understood, but I might not be able to leave the main verb out of a sentence and still be understood. So it's the same with the genome, and it's really quite a detective story to try to piece together what exactly is the grammar for a particular gene. Natural languages are also context sensitive, especially if we're talking about English. It matters what the order of the words is, and it matters what words are next to what other words. If I put an adjective next to a noun, presumably that adjective is modifying that noun. Well, so is the grammar of the genome, as far as we're understanding it, context sensitive. So I could take one of my modular pieces of grammar and put it in a different context in amongst other sequences and have a somewhat different result. So natural language metaphor works pretty well here for what we're starting to uncover about the way this works. And it also has an element of cocktail party chatter to it. So if you think about being in a crowded room with a lot of people, a lot of conversations going on, lots of noise, lots of information floating around, you're trying to focus in on the one little conversation that you're involved with. There's really a lot to be said for having a modular, redundant, context-sensitive language that you're communicating in. In other words, if you're in a situation where there's a lot of chatter, there's a lot of noise, and the cell is exactly that. It's full of chatter. It's full of noise. It's full of information being passed around quickly. One of the good ways to do this is to not have too parsimonious a language. That is, you don't want to be communicating with the minimal thing that you could possibly be saying with just single words, because there's more of a chance of being misunderstood, more of a chance of not being heard, more of a chance of not realizing what the context is. So actually, the more redundant a language is, and the more modular it is, and the more repetitions that you can make of a particular piece of information, the more you can overcome the idea that the cell is absolutely full of communications that are going all the time and needing to be sorted out in order to get things done correctly. Let me talk about some of the types of mutations that can occur when something goes wrong with the grammar. And I'm going to just give you a few examples, and you can imagine many others once you see the sorts of examples they are. Possibly we'll have a gene and we'll end up saying, make two of those, make two eyes, make two elbows. The sort of mutation I'm talking about could be something like, make 20 of those, or don't make any of those. Or I might say, make this particular product when we have a new embryo, and that new embryo is going to need this particular product, but don't make it in an adult. And the mutation could be simply, make this all the time, including in an adult. Make it inappropriately and all the time. So these sorts of mutations are really the foundations of what could possibly go right and what could possibly go wrong with the building of a multicellular organism. Now, let me give you another image for how to envision how this works, and we're actually going to come back to the Y chromosome, which I said we would do a couple of lectures back. There are some genes that control the grammar and coordinate the grammar of other genes. So I don't really have a good natural language metaphor for this phenomenon. I'm going to have to switch to a slightly different metaphor. Think again of a cascade. Think of a complex pathway with lots of branching points. And think of the gene that is at the top of the cascade producing a product that will do nothing more than go and talk to other genes and tell them what to do. Turn on, turn off, make two of these, make three of these, don't make any more of these. And then let's say each of those genes also will go and talk to yet more genes further down in the cascade. So from that one bit of information, there'll be two or three genes that will now be responding. And for each of those two or three genes, maybe two or three more genes, so that by the time we're done with this cascade, we have a whole set of coordinating grammatical statements, a story essentially. We've put together a story that says, here's a heart that we're going to make. We're going to put it just one in the right place, of the right shape, and of the right size. Doesn't it make sense that you'd need thousands of genes all coordinating to do that? And doesn't it make sense that you might have a master control sort of gene at the beginning of it all, launching the entire enterprise of putting together an entire heart in the correct way? That's what I want you to envision. This is sometimes called a regulatory cascade, for the cascade image of having a master control gene that's controlling the grammar of all the ones that are down below it. And it's completely appropriate to think of cascades as producing major organs, such as a heart or such as some other part of the body like that. So now let's switch to that Y chromosome that we were talking about. Remember, we were talking about the Y chromosome as the chromosome that confers a male phenotype or characteristics, secondary and primary sexual characteristics of males. And it was a puzzle as to how this was working. And then there was that wonderful study at Mass General Hospital in which it was found that a little piece of the Y chromosome had crossed over onto an X, and we had a few examples of males who had two X chromosomes and were still showing male sexual characteristics because they had that little crucial bit of the Y attached to their X or crossed into their X, actually spliced into their X or edited into their X. Well, what was on that little bit of Y chromosome? A master regulatory gene at the top of a cascade that controls the grammar of a host of other genes below it on the cascade to confer male primary and secondary sex characteristics. So it was the discovery of a wonderful master control gene that has this really profound activity throughout the rest of a set of thousands of other genes that are going to do something really complicated in a coordinated sort of way. By the way, I want to describe what this gene is actually coding for, because it's actually a nice image. It's a nicely named gene product, which I can't say for many gene products that I know, but this one actually has a nice name. That master control gene on the Y chromosome codes for a zinc finger protein, zinc finger. Nice image. It's actually got zincs in it, and those zincs help that protein to fold such that it looks like it's got little fingers. So if you hold out your hand and look at your own fingers and imagine those fingers gripping something, right? If you've got fingers, you can move them and grip something. That's what that gene product is doing. It's going out to other genes, moving over to them, and gripping something in their upstream regions. Actually, that zinc finger that's produced on the Y chromosome is going out and touching and binding to the upstream regions of a bunch of other genes, and that's the mechanism by which this whole coordination begins. By the way, zinc finger proteins are not unique to the Y chromosome or unique to this particular function. There are lots and lots of zinc finger proteins running around the cell doing all their various activities to produce organ systems and tissues, etc. We've been talking about consequences of having something go wrong with the regulatory system or the grammatical system in somewhat negative terms. I've evoked the image of birth defects, organs misplaced, organs in multiples when they should not be, perhaps organs that are misshaped, all of which we're now blaming on the grammar of the cell, the higher level grammar that goes way beyond just individual genes that are making particular organs. But what I want to talk about now is a more positive aspect of this and something that you can easily observe yourself. Okay, so I would like to put this into the kind of everyday concept that you can talk about by simply pointing out particular examples that we have in a much more positive way. Take a look at a book of dog breeds, as I've already suggested you might do, to have a look at the wonderful different colors of dogs, but take another look at that book of all the breeds of dogs, or take a look at a book that shows you breeds of chickens or breeds of fancy pigeons. And by the way, fancy pigeons had a strong influence on Darwin. He used to raise fancy pigeons and was amazed by the different shapes that you can get by pigeon fanciers who have caused these just extraordinary different changes in the pigeon body type. Or look for a book of goldfish breeds and be absolutely amazed at what has happened to the goldfish lineage in domestication. People have various aesthetic tastes in what they would like goldfish to look like, and my goodness, a lot of them are just extraordinary, looking like something from a different planet. Or if you prefer flowers, look at a book about daffodils and be amazed at all the different shapes of daffodils that humans have caused to occur through selective breeding. And know that all of the different shapes and sizes and strange positions of organs and tissues, which in some case can happen, all of these are mutations on the level of gene regulation. Okay, so let's say that you have a goldfish with its eyes kind of sticking up at the top of its head, almost on a little telescope, a little pair of sort of telescope-like eyes, which some of the strange breeds of goldfish can look like, with maybe kind of bubble-like structures on its head. Some people like goldfish that have really extraordinary structures like that. Those are structures that are the results of manipulating and selecting for the genes that are regulating other genes. Or let's say you have a breed of dog in which the nose is no longer elongated as it was originally in the wolves from which all dogs descended. Say the nose is pushed in a little bit the way you might have in a French bulldog, for example. That's a mutation that occurred in that dog's lineage that affected lots of genes. That's a change in the grammar of the way that nose was constructed and the way that nose grew or did not grow during the embryonic stages of that dog, and which humans chose for aesthetic reasons or for other reasons. Think of dogs with shortened legs, like dachshunds. Think of dogs that are very, very tiny, like all of the various miniature breeds. Think of enormous dogs. Think of dogs with ears of various shapes. And we're in the realm of the kind of mutation that affects the grammar in profound ways of whole sets of genes. I especially love daffodils. And one of the things that you could do is get yourself to a public garden at the right time of year where you know that daffodils will be grown in abundance and all different varieties and strains of them. Be amazed at how many different ways there are for petals to look, how many different ways there are for the corolla to look, the center part of the daffodil. And all of this is mutation on the level of the grammar of the cell. And it's especially noticeable in flowers once you realize that it's the case that if you've got varieties of roses, they have different numbers of petals. If you've got varieties of almost any other flower, one of the favorite ways to vary them is to change the petal number and to change the petal shape. So these are all grammatical changes in the way the animal or the plant is being bred. Here are some particular other examples that you might enjoy. In plants, there is a particular sort of mutation called faciation, F-A-S-C-I-A-T-I-O-N, coming from the word meaning bundle of sticks. In fact, it's derived from the same word that fascism comes from, bundle of sticks. And it's something that you can spot once you know what you're looking for. You can spot pretty readily in plants. It's a little bit like a conjoined twin type of mutation. Okay, so if we're talking about mammals, it would be twins that were born joined together in some particular place. But in plants, it comes out looking not quite like a birth defect and more like just a really interesting variation. So here are some examples in which you've got doubled up structures in plants that you can spot. It's the explanation for four-leaf clovers. Okay, so there you go. Clovers are typically three leaves. How come we get an extra leaf? Well, we've got a sort of a faciation, a mild faciation mutation. It's the reason some tomatoes look so bumpy and strange, almost as though we've taken two or three tomatoes and kind of welded them together and made this great big sort of heirloom tomato structure that you sometimes see. That's a faciation mutation. I mean, that if you're thinking it looks as though we've put together some tomatoes in kind of a haphazard way, well, we sort of have done that. It's why broccoli and cauliflower, which remember are derived from little skinny wild mustard and wild radish, it's why they have such big, thick stems and why they look as though they might have been duplicated in some particular way to make this enormous kind of structure that we eat, broccoli and cauliflower. That's an example of a faciation mutation. And there are sometimes when you can find dandelions that have a really peculiar multiplication of stems and flowers that is a classic facciation mutation that I really wanted to mention because I recall seeing this growing up as a child and being really puzzled about this. And now I want to give you the confidence to be able to say, well, I can't tell you exactly what gene is involved, but I can tell you it's pretty important. It's got to be pretty high in a regulatory cascade in order to have a multiplication of structures like that. I want to switch here to talking a little bit about stem cells, which are often in the news, which have various controversies connected to them. But I want to talk about them in one particular context. There are biologists who are working very hard on finding a way to take stem cells and to use them to heal wounds, heal serious injuries, and rebuild organs in some cases, and in general to deal with some really major problems that occur in human medicine, in medicine of other animals, in which you want to rebuild or reconnect or redo some aspect of some tissue or organ. And the idea is that you might get stem cells from some source that have not yet made major commitments to their grammar. Let me tell you what I mean by that. Early in embryogenesis, as the embryo is developing, there need to be major long-term commitments to a particular set of grammar. Think about my elbow and eye again. I want my elbow to be committed to be my elbow forever. I don't want to have halfway through my life a different set of grammatical rules come in such that I end up with an extra elbow sprouting out or eyes sprouting out of my elbow or some peculiar thing like that. I need long-term commitment. And what people who are looking into stem cells are saying is, can we find cells that have not yet made this long-term commitment to be elbows, to be eyes, to be heart, whatever? Can we get these cells and then can we guide them into the correct grammatical decisions such that we can say, make a new spinal cord or make a new heart or make a new part of some other part of the body. So it's a very powerful idea. It's a very important idea. Some of the controversy, I think, comes out not so much from the idea of doing this, but the source of the stem cells, I think, is where a lot of the controversy comes from. There are two major sources of stem cells that people are considering. One is stem cells from your own body, from your own adult body, that happen to be the sort of cells that have not yet made major commitments to what organ or tissue they're going to be involved with. Taking some of those stem cells and then guiding them in the direction that you would like to guide them in so that you end up making whatever tissue it is that you would like to do. The other source is embryos. And of course, that brings up all sorts of controversies that are not appropriate for me to talk about because I'm not going to put any value judgments on sources of stem cells. And we'll leave it to you to consider what you want to think about that. But that is the other major source of stem cells, that you might take embryos, frozen embryos, perhaps from fertility clinics. And those are likely to be full of uncommitted cells, cells that are not yet committed to grammar. And there's your source of stem cells that could possibly be an important source of wound healing and other sorts of organ rebuilding that could be used in medicine. Let's talk about behavior a little bit. We've touched on behavior in a number of different ways, and we have talked about how complicated it is, so that I would be very, very hesitant to take seriously a statement that we just found the gene for aggression or the gene for math genius. We've talked about how complicated the interactions have to be. And they are also complicated in the sense that there's a great deal of coordination that has to occur as behavior and what will be the behavior of a developing embryo develops over the course of when they're in utero. And imagine lots of different genes being turned off or turned on, lots of grammatical decisions being made, an enormous developmental sort of a cascade of decisions that are being made that give us what psychologists might define as normal behavior. So what we get out of all of these interactions and all of these genes that are either affecting each other's grammar or having their grammar affected, what we get out of that is normal interactions. And I bring this up because I've talked about some behavioral disabilities or effects in terms of a spectrum. And I use the autistic spectrum as an example. I said that on one end of the autistic spectrum were people with high functioning Asperger's, and then perhaps next were low functioning Asperger's, and then perhaps high functioning autistic people, all the way to relatively low functioning autistic people. And I said that I want you to think about that spectrum of possibilities in terms of all the different possible alleles and all the different possible interactions in a wonderfully complex pathway that gives us what we call normal human interactions. Now layer on the possibilities of grammar, and you get a wonderfully complex picture, and one that actually gives us some challenges as we try to sort out, just for one example, what the genetic components of autism are. And it's why, and I'm just going to use this one example because it's something that I sometimes use in my genetics class, it's why if you go looking through the literature trying to find where they're locating the genes that might be involved with the autistic spectrum, why they're finding lots of them all over the place and all of the different chromosomes or many of the different chromosomes, and why there does not seem to be just one single gene. We wouldn't expect there to be one single gene, but sometimes lay people are expecting to find one single gene, and why the picture looks so complicated. It's something that is being sorted out, but it's something that is going to be one of the more complicated things to really understand. What makes normal behavior, and then what makes all the various nuanced versions of behavior that is considered to be not normal. Now, I want to tell you about a really fun experiment done by the fruit fly people. And they were able to do it because fruit flies are especially susceptible to getting dramatic mutations in their grammatical use, the gene regulation, and those not being lethal. That's the important addition. And those not being lethal, and you can maintain those flies in the lab. There are many, many mutations of this sort in which you end up with a problematic enough birth defect-like effect that it's actually very difficult to keep the animal alive. But fruit flies seem to go cheerily on their merry way in spite of many really dramatic mutations. And I want to give you an example of one that was caused to fruit flies that is really indicative of how important evolutionarily this particular sort of regulatory system is. So there are birth defects that affect eyes in humans. And so let me say that there is an eye gene that's somewhere near the top of an important cascade of interactions that's going to give us proper development of an eye. So that's a human eye development gene, such that if something goes wrong with it, we may get a birth defect concerning the eyes. And flies also have their version of a gene that, if it is mutated, will also have a profound effect on the development of their eyes. You could say that the fruit flies also have their version of a birth defect, such that their eyes don't properly get developed and don't end up in the right place and in the right numbers. So one question was, considering that fruit flies and humans have been separate on the evolutionary tree for about 500 million years, 500 million years, they've gone their separate ways, could there possibly be any connection between the eye birth defect genes of humans and the eye birth defect genes of fruit flies? And notice I named those genes in kind of a negative way. These are the eye development genes, but we notice them when we have a problem with them. So I'm calling them eye birth defect genes. Could there be some similarity in the basic grammar? And the answer is there's a lot of similarity in the basic grammar. One of the reasons for that is because it's so important that there really has not been that much change in the way the grammar is set up, even after 500 million years. What the researchers did was take the human eye birth defect gene, and they had a way of putting it into the fly cells so that it was essentially all over the body of the fly. And then using an artificial system, they were able to turn that gene on. They were able to arrange the grammar such that they were able to get that gene to be active all over the fly body. Remember, this is a human gene. And they were able to get eyes to pop out all over the fly. Dozen or so eyes, looking like little malformed eyes, but on the thorax, on the abdomen, the different sections of the fly. And they were even able to determine that those eyes were sensitive to light, because when they flashed some light at those little eyes that were sprouting out all over the place, they were able to get a little neuron response suggesting that the eyes had actually registered the light. This actually goes hand in hand with a whole set of other really dramatic mutations that can occur in fruit flies, in which there are misplaced structures. And it's actually through fruit flies that a lot of the real fundamentals of what I've been talking about have been worked out. For a long time, people have noticed that there are mutations in which there are dramatically misplaced body parts in flies. These are flies in the laboratory, of course, with wonderful names, by the way. For example, there's one called Antennapedia. That's where you have legs sticking out of the head where the antennae should be. Or Ophthalmaptera, coming from the word meaning eye, and aptera means wings. That's wings coming out of the eyes. So wings that are actually misplaced. And so wonderful names, typical of the fruit fly people, of trying to indicate what the mutation is. And it's through understanding those sorts of mutations, as well as the one that I just described that was artificially constructed using the human eye birth defect gene, that a lot of the gene regulation pathways have been worked out. And the good news is that a lot of what gets worked out for fruit flies is applicable to all sorts of other organisms, including humans, because we're talking about the real fundamental basic grammars that cause things to happen in cells. So in the next lecture, we're going to talk about another somewhat advanced topic, but one that I think that we have preparation for at this point. And that is the relatively new idea that has developed from the Human Genome Project and from other genome projects of trying to understand better what all the rest of our DNA is doing. Okay, we have 10% of it as genes. A certain amount is these special regulatory regions or grammatical regions, but what's the rest of the DNA doing and what does it all mean?
This ends Lecture 12.